Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show is going to be a bit of a location piece I did. Wanted to look at how the issues of depression and psychological pressure can impact a student in a post-secondary setting. I'm here with a great college student, Jenna Milanis, who's going to be sharing a little bit about her story of mental health and recovery. So what can you tell me about your story?
My journey with mental health, with depression and anxiety. Depression affects you mentally, spiritually, emotionally. It is something you experience on your own, and you really can't put it in words.
So there was a recent challenge you were kind of struggling with. Can you elaborate a little on that?
With anxiety, affected me recently with schooling because I felt helpless. I was close to withdrawing because I felt a lot of pressure. I could not find hope and faith within myself to pursue my goal and diploma.
Well, can you tell me a little bit about some of the supports that have proven helpful for you?
I realized I was close to completing my college diploma, also the support of family and friends.
So, the program itself, do you find that they respond well to people with mental health needs, or do you find that the professors are willing to listen or to provide extra support?
I believe it's 50-50. It depends on everyone's situation.
Truly, it is a matter of what the student needs and what sort of supports are available. So looking at it from that angle is just a matter of just asking for the help you need, asking for the supports, and maybe recognizing this in yourself. So in your time at the college studying as a student affected with mental health conditions, have there been any success moments that stand out for you in your work?
Absolutely. There is success because out of the 12 courses I needed to get, I had 10 of them, and I'm so close, so I'm not giving up.
So if you could send any one message to your fellow students and the community about the need to find the strength in yourself to carry on and to do well, what might you say?
I believe you should never give up with yourself because you can do anything you put your mind to.
What do you foresee for the future of your education? Do you think you'll finish?
Absolutely, I'll finish. I will get my diploma and may even do second year for executive.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you.
Of course.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Kristen Tramer, Stephanie Craig, and Shan Johnson will be telling us a little bit more about their efforts to get a chapter of the Turner Syndrome Society brought here to Windsor. So tell me a little bit about the further efforts to bring a chapter of the Turner Syndrome Society here to Windsor.
Well, there are Turner Syndrome Society chapters throughout Canada, and since Canada is such a large country, they're extremely widely dispersed. And there are a lot of locations who don't really have any local support groups. So there are chapters in Toronto, in Ottawa, in Quebec, in Vancouver. They're getting one started in the Maritimes. But there's nothing, there's no chapter really as Southern Canada as we are. The closest would be Toronto. So what we would like to do, since Windsor is a fairly large city, and we knew there are a decent number of individuals and family members of individuals with Turner syndrome, we thought it would be a great resource to start up a chapter here. And Kristen can talk a little bit about our connection with the U.S. Turner Syndrome Society also.
Well, I am not only a member of the Turner Syndrome Society of Canada, but I'm also a member of the Turner Syndrome Society of the United States. And so in the U.S., there are also many, many local Turner Syndrome groups. But very similar to here in Canada, many of them are, I guess I would say, more housed towards almost larger, more urban environments where they're more populous. And so one of the things, I think, being here in Windsor that makes this such kind of a unique experience is that we can make connections internationally across the border between Windsor and Detroit. And Stephanie and I are, making our connections here. And so we want to be able to broaden that experience. And I think this is kind of a great opportunity to do so, and I think get awareness out there, and hopefully, we can also inspire other areas that maybe might not have as large of a population, try and start very similar efforts and start their own groups and chapters, because I feel like making connections between individuals who are affected by Turner syndrome is very, very important.
I have to say, Cameron, that for myself personally, I really appreciate what you've done for us, because you're the first media that's reached, well, no, I guess I can't say the first media. We did get an article in the Windsor Star, which we were very grateful for and received one call on. But this is the second media that's reached out to us. And still trying to get the letters out to the doctors, that would be appropriate to see, that they would have patients that would be likely to have Turner syndrome. So we're still trying.
So what do you suppose the difficulty is in communication between all the organizations, which I'm sure their hearts are in the right place, but they could certainly profit from better communication, better outreach. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I think that's something that the Turner Syndrome Society has really been trying to work towards within the last couple years, especially with utilizing social media more effectively. We do have a Facebook group, as well as we're on Twitter. We've just recently implemented a discussion board on our website that connects individuals from all over Canada, a free discussion board. So it's something we're really trying to do. And I think, the complications, again, go back to the fact with how wide of a country Canada is. And so that's one of the things that we're trying to do, is really trying to establish regulations with the groups and chapters, so all the groups and chapters are following the same laws and regulations and communicating with each other. We're starting to be more firm about sending out monthly updates of each group and chapter, so that everyone's aware of what all the other groups are doing. So hopefully through that increased communication, we'll start to see more connections forming.
There's an awkward, and you can edit this out, of course, but there's an awkward question in my mind. I think there's still somewhat of a stigma. I was going into my church for a meeting, and walking beside me was a woman that was about my size, and I hadn't been introduced to her. I didn't meet her, just kind of nodded heads, and she was to one event, I was to the other. And when I get to where I was going, I kind of whispered to some friends of mine, I really wanted to ask her if she had Turner syndrome. There was another lady, actually there's two women that I know who have mentioned small daughter, small niece, and I'm thinking, I would really like to ask. And there's that societal thing that keeps me from asking. I'm feeling like I would be intrusive.
Well, it is a valid medical question, and fact is, communication is key in getting awareness out for any condition.
Absolutely, and I think I've had very similar experiences to what you're describing, Shan, where I've seen another individual, or I've heard stories, and I want to put the question out there, but I don't necessarily want, if they're not comfortable disclosing, kind of perhaps force them into that situation. And so I think part of the communication is doing just what we're doing here, where we're coming on, we're talking about our experiences, and even our disclosure, I've realized that often leads other people, then if you put it out there, they're willing to respond and reciprocate. And I've had many people that once they find out that I have Turner syndrome, they come up to me and they say, my niece or I have Turner syndrome, and the dialogue just starts to flow. And so I think that's a really great way to just even start that communication process.
Frankly, one is too many. If a condition's affecting even one person in society, it should be talked about. There should be public awareness, because chances are it's not limited to one person. Windsor being a border city, we do need this chapter. So, if each of you could send any one message about what needs to happen in regards to Turner syndrome awareness, what would you say?
I would give a message to the doctors that Stephanie's name is in the public as an affiliate of the Turner Syndrome Society of Canada, to reach out to her. I would most certainly and have given permission for people to reach out for me. So I would want the medical community, when they have a patient who presents, get the information back to us. We've got a wonderful school of medicine here. And I'd like to more utilize that.
One thing that I would like to mention is the fact that, you know, Turner syndrome is just that, a syndrome. There's a wide variability in the effects that it can have on the individual. And so if you are an individual just recently diagnosed with Turner syndrome, a family member who's just found out their child or relative has been diagnosed with Turner syndrome, or you're a medical professional who is starting to think that a patient might have Turner syndrome and you're testing for it, you know, please don't. A lot of times the worst case scenario is what you see if you do online searches, or even there's a lot of misperceptions still going around in the medical community and medical research, medical textbooks. So please, you know, do your research, get second opinions, contact the Turner Syndrome Society of Canada or the Turner Syndrome Society of US. We can put you in touch with individuals in your area that you can connect with. Also, we can send you free resources. We can send you information about the online discussion group where you can get in contact with people and ask questions. And, you know, just because you get this diagnosis of Turner syndrome doesn't mean that it's a worst case scenario. You know, you've Shan, who has done so many amazing things here in Windsor with working at the library at the university, all her involvement in politics, in her political advocacy, and you have Kristen and I, who are pursuing our PhDs in psychology, as well as other individuals with Turner syndrome that I know of who have master's degrees, PhDs, or pursuing nursing. So please, if you do get this diagnosis, you know, don't give up. You really can accomplish anything you set out for.
May I add one other thing quickly?
Certainly.
Stephanie said that, you know, the worst case scenario is what is presented, even at you know, when there's fetal testing. And it's kind of like, you know, the pill bottles, like aspirin, low dose, and may cause death, you know. So it's the same thing, like that worst case scenario is at the bottom of the list.
I agree completely. And I think one of my messages would be sometimes you have to look for the zebras and not the horses.
Law and Order reference.
And that I think is very characteristic of my experience. So nearly half of women with Turner syndrome were not diagnosed until adolescence. And I was one of those young women. I was not diagnosed until I was 16. And I had a number of health issues that were very strongly tied to Turner syndrome, but nobody made those connections. If something new came up, it was just related to another diagnosis that I already had. So it took a long time for me to be diagnosed, and that's not an uncommon story. So if you're a medical, if you are a medical professional, keep your eyes open, be aware, and I think it's so important to educate clinicians in the medical community about Turner syndrome so that we can start getting individuals diagnosed at a much earlier age. Especially for me, it was very scary because we had no idea about my heart conditions until I had my diagnosis of Turner syndrome. And so I went 16 years of my life without knowing that I needed something that I had something going on that needed to be treated from
the teachers in school right now. I mean, they're going to notice young girls mm-hmm. that maybe have spatial learning, maybe have number learning, mm-hmm. Maybe aren't growing as fast as their other peers. Mm-hmm. Call out to teachers in training.
I'd like to thank you all for taking the time out to do this.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Of course. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Have you ever thought about volunteering with CJAM FM? Why haven't you? Volunteering isn't limited to students. Anyone from the community can come into the station and start their very own program. All you need are a pair of headphones and the enthusiasm to learn. So get involved right here in your community with a topical spoken word show or music program where you choose the content. Email programcjam@gmail.com or come on down to the station. We're located on the University of Windsor campus in the basement of the CAW Student Center. Find out more information about how you can volunteer at cjam.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about student pressures and the depression therein from college student Jenna Milanis, and we heard from a panel of Turner's experts, Stephanie Craig, Shan Johnson, and Kristen Tramer. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Sean Whitshire about the DRPI Aware Project. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with the DRPI Aware Project.
Well, 2 years ago, I was asked by Marcia Ryu, who's the lead researcher on the project, to basically she phoned me one Friday afternoon and said, "Would you like to go on an adventure?" Absolutely. She had sort of checked my background, and I had done employment services for, over 22 years in Canada. And this was a huge opportunity I never thought I would ever have the chance to take. And so it was just 30 days after the phone call, I found myself in Kathmandu. And I think that the biggest thing that I saw was just the commonality of folks with disabilities looking for employment, not wanting to be trained for jobs that didn't exist, the barriers that employers felt in hiring somebody, they were the exact same ones that I dealt with in Canada. So I was kind of a little taken aback that similar issues were surfacing. And so that was something that gave us some ability to sort of look at what were some of the solutions, how could we find the experiences of other people in Canada and translate that, taking into account culture in Southeast Asia. I think sometimes I would have liked to have somebody sat me down before I went and kind of told me a little bit about the experience, because there is culture shock. You are going to the other side of the world where things are different. And I think that that has probably been the greatest, most wonderful learning experience I could have ever asked for. It's changed my view of my work. It's changed my view of how I do my work. And I see it as a much broader piece now. I mean, we're affecting change. We're, you know, the colleagues I've learned to work with in each of the three countries, Nepal, Bangladesh, and India, you know, we've all learned something from each other. And the experience of going to these countries and working with these individuals has been absolutely amazing. You know, I don't want to overstate it, but some of it has been life-changing because you don't see and experience everything that you experience there in Canada. Yes, there's a lot of commonality around helping somebody, you know, sort of determine what their skills are and taking those skills and marketing them. But the environment, whether it be healthcare or education or just how folks with disabilities are in within the community, that can be a challenge too. So it's been an amazing experience, and we've got another year in the project. It was never, I don't think, supposed to be this long, and it's just been something that has been truly fascinating and rewarding. And, you know, every week we have a conference call with them. We're talking about the challenges. We're working through issues. So it's a very hands-on process. And then a couple of times a year, there's a trip where we go and we work with local employers and government and local disability groups to empower them to sort of help move the process beyond when we're there. It's very important, I think, for the whole Disability Rights Promotion International project to have something left at the end so that people can take it forward. And that's been something I think that we've really seen. I think the other really interesting thing is the take up from employers once they discover the benefits of diversity and disability, you know, that they haven't looked at before. And that's been something. So repeat business has been something we've seen with the employers that we worked with both in India and in Nepal.
So what's been the greatest success that you've witnessed in the promotion of disability rights as far as employment?
I think some of it has to do with the attitudinal shift, finding those employer champions who are able to deliver the message much more effectively to their other business owners. Business to business always works better. In particular, I'm going to talk a little bit about Central India and Hyderabad. We have just had some really great success with a particular company called Rockwell Freezers. And they have been, you know, they were a supportive employer, you know, helping folks with disabilities be employed before. And now they've just taken it another step further in their factory. They're looking at their supply chain. They've done something really incredible, because when you go to the factory and you meet the individuals with disabilities, they're working on the floor, limited accommodation to support their role in the production of the freezer, but it's very much supported by the whole factory floor. And I think seeing those kind of changes and supporting those kinds of changes with the employers and, you know, the chambers of commerce in each of the cities that we work in has been very, very beneficial to the long-term process. So it's an education. It's a, you know, what is the business case? You know, I often tell people businesses aren't in business to employ people. Businesses are in business to make money. And so we say to employers, we want you to make more money so you can hire more folks with disabilities. It's sell the skill.
So if you could send any one message about the need for inclusion and employment on a global scale, what would you say?
That the economics of inclusion demand that we step up and include folks. We constantly talk about companies wanting to be innovative and be more profitable. Innovation comes from diversification. When you apply a new view to an old or new problem, you find different solutions. Folks with disabilities, new Canadians, other people who are marginalized, they process and think differently because they are forced to adapt to barriers every day. So when they see a problem, they approach it differently. And this gives them the ability to be more innovative, to look at problems and find solutions. That's what companies want. Companies want people who are able to find solutions. Well, if you're a blind individual in Mumbai, getting to work is a major accomplishment. So the job would, you know, is not going to be as difficult. So we often say to people, you have skills. And I think that valuing the economics of inclusion are what we would say globally. We need individuals with disabilities in our workforce. We require their skills, and we have there are jobs to fill. There are jobs to fill around the world. If we can find a job for somebody who is, you know, paraplegic in Nepal, we can do it in Canada.
So, what are the next immediate steps for the project going forward?
Well, we've been really working lately on getting some more of the message out and acknowledging some of the partners that we have been able to work with, sort of a ramping up of that employer champion piece. So over the last number of months, we've been trying to work with the local employers to not only both identify the champions that we want to sort of promote, but working with them at a local level to allow them to tell other businesses how it's been beneficial to them. So that's been the last number of months. We're going to be going shortly, actually, for another visit. And one of those opportunities is, again, to meet with larger organizations, to meet with some of the employers that have hired multiple people. And it's a way to build that business case that allows people to understand that diversity is beneficial.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can...
No problem.
The perfect question. If we can find work for a paraplegic in Nepal, why can't we find work for people here at home with disabilities? Could it be that in some ways we're still living in shyness, dancing around certain issues of disability? When Jenna was doing her interview talking about the depression and the pressure she experiences as a student, it doesn't just stop there, folks. That sort of depression and pressure can spread to the rest of a person's life. And it is not our place as a society to say, because you're feeling this and it's not something that we're especially comfortable looking upon, we're not going to give you the right opportunities. But during Jenna's interview, she talked about the need to keep on going. And education about disabilities and education for people with disabilities go hand in hand. Creating for the future, knowing your own rights, knowing that it can be done. 9 times out of 10 in disability life, there's at least some adaptation that can be made. Something that can be done to make things better. Might not be an immediate cure, but it can change things from a hopeless, dark place to where there's at least a little kernel of hope, to where you can see that spark of life. That's what everyone's entitled to in education, in employment, whether they have Turner syndrome, paralysis, blindness, deafness, whatever the condition, equal access means equal for all. Not just for those who walk a certain way, talk a certain way, or think a certain way. Equality is a matter of the one thing that binds us all together, our humanity. And no one can deny that is what we all are. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.